From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
I'm here this morning with Admiral Gary Ruffhead, a former U.S. Navy officer who served in his final position in the U.S. Navy as the 29th U.S. Chief of Naval Operations from 2007 to 2011. I had the honor of working with him a little as I was China Director in the National Security Council, and as he and I have discussed before, I always appreciated his leadership and his vision in that position. He's held six operational commands through his career, and he's one of only two officers in the history of the U.S. Navy to have commanded both U.S. Atlantic and Pacific fleets. Admiral Ruffhead, we're very grateful to have you on the Carnegie Tsinghua podcast this morning, we really appreciated it when you were out in 2015 participating in the Tsinghua World Peace Forum, and Carnegie Tsinghua did a panel there on U.S.-China. And it's great to talk to you this morning. So thank you for joining the podcast.
Well, Paul, it's great to be on the podcast, and thank you for your kind words, and thank you for the work that you do in China.
I would like, if I could, to talk to you about three topics this morning, of which you have considerable experience and expertise: South China Sea, U.S.-China military-to-military relations, and North Korea, which is once again in the headlines. Let's start with the South China Sea. This is an issue that has dominated the headlines over the last few years. China has moved along a much more assertive approach than we have seen in the past. They've reclaimed features, conducted reclamation activities, frankly, that is, when you add it all up, more than the entire history of reclamation in the Asia Pacific. They've done it at a pace and a scope that is unprecedented. It has raised tensions in the region considerably and has become an issue front and center in the U.S.-China relationship, and one that has created some quite a bit of tension. In July of this year, there was a ruling by the UNCLOS Tribunal which invalidated China's expansive claims in the South China Sea. Now, there has been a bit of a cool down in the South China Sea, but some speculate that's because China wanted the G20 to go off well, wanted President Obama to be present at the G20, and people wonder what to expect now going forward. I want to step back, if I could, and just ask you, given your experience, given your positions in the U.S. government, what do you see here is at stake in terms of the strategic competition in the Asia Pacific for the U.S. and China? What are we seeing playing out? And broadly speaking, how do you see it going forward?
Yeah. Well, I've been watching that area for many years, and it remains an important area of focus for me. I'll focus in on the South China Sea, but I really do believe that you can't divorce the East China Sea. Absolutely. And the South China Sea.
Right.
As an issue for the region and the types of activities that the U.S. and our allies and like-minded partners need to be mindful of. In the South China Sea, first off, I really don't believe that that a conflict is imminent in the South China Sea. That said, I do believe that as activity increases, as the operators on scene may become emboldened, I believe that you increase the risk of a misstep or a mm-hmm. mistake or a mishap. And the problem then becomes one of how do you de-escalate it? And there really aren't adequate mechanisms mm-hmm. there among the region and China to be able to calmly and confidently walk down the steps and back into a better position. So I really am. That's my main concern.
You hear people say that just the fact that there's China has more ships and aircraft operating in the area, the U.S. and others are sort of picking up their operations, that just by itself creates a greater risk for inadvertent clash. Do you see that as a real threat?
I think that the increased activity mm-hmm. and the increased population, if you want to use that term, mm-hmm. population of military assets and Coast Guard assets, because that's mm-hmm. primarily the force that's being used, I do think that that increases probability. The other dimension of it is that the facilities that China has built out in the South China Sea have military value, and there's no question about that. And I think that's one of the main things that has unsettled so many people as to, you know, what is really happening in that important waterway. I think it's hugely important what the Court of Arbitration did. Mm-hmm. The ability to provide an interpretation, not ruling on sovereignty,
right.
but rather what are the features and what is the map of the water that surrounds that, I think is hugely mm-hmm. important. And I believe that too can provide a way ahead for many of the other disputes that are in play in the region. Mm-hmm. But I think it is important that the countries, to include the United States, look at this in a very calm and pragmatic way. Mm. To be able to cooperate in ways that allow us and others to share information so we have ground truth as to what is happening there, to be able to operate freely in that area. And the U.S., as you know, has mm. conducted freedom of navigation operations. I believe those should continue. I leave it to the circumstances and the leadership at the time to determine whether that should be innocent passage or not innocent mm-hmm. passage. But it should be part of a menu of activities that we pursue and others pursue that demonstrate the freedom of the seas mm-hmm. and the ability for countries who follow a rules-based order to operate in that important area. I think it's also key that we conduct other types of operations and mm-hmm. exercises to include with the Chinese. There's no reason why you can't do humanitarian assistance, search mm-hmm. and rescue, environmental response. All of these can be part of a constructive set of activities. And then also to begin to put in place viable means of knowing what is going on, and we refer to that as maritime domain awareness or air domain awareness. Mm-hmm. How can you share information so everyone has accurate information that won't then lead to some of these missteps that we started talking about at the beginning?
See, you know, you lay out a more comprehensive approach than we hear discussed often, which I think is important. I want to ask specifically on the freedom of navigation issue, because this has been an issue that you see in the headlines, mm-hmm. which isn't always helpful in terms of working through tension. But nevertheless, there has been what appears to be some reluctance up until recently by the administration to pursue freedom of navigation operations fairly regularly. What do you make of that reluctance, and how do you do the things that you laid out in a way that actually contribute to decreasing tension and not actually provoking greater tension?
Yeah. Well, Paul, you've been in government as well and at fairly significant levels, and you realize that a decision for a particular action has many factors that flow into it. Schedules, events that are coming up, other areas or issues that countries may be working on, all that is part of the calculus.
Yeah.
So I won't get into what has been in people's minds. But I think one of the things that we really need to do is, as we conduct freedom of navigation operations, which in my view are not deterrence operations. Deterrence operations are completely different mm-hmm. from freedom of navigation. Freedom of navigation is there to demonstrate freedom of the seas mm-hmm. and the basis of law in those activities. I think one of the things that we need to do is to not be announcing or indicating what we're about. That only begins to cause a counter-reaction even
right.
before something has happened.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe it's important that as activities are taken, whether they're freedom of navigation or the broader set of activities that I talked about, that we don't crow about them, that we don't make a big deal about them, because countries will know what we're doing. But once it gets into a hyperventilating public space, then it causes others to have to react. So I think continue the activities, but tone down the noise. But it's also important that when we do these, we do them without forewarning, because that kind of removes the purpose of what they're about.
Sound advice, very sound advice. Another area that you've had very sound advice in the past is on the military-to-military relationship. You and I remember specifically talking over lunch in the Pentagon, in fact, with you, about looking at how our navies and militaries interact in the Asia Pacific, and seeing the difference in how our navies and militaries interact in other parts of the world. And I remember you making the point that we're actually doing counter-piracy operations, other type of things, in some ways are easier when you're doing them outside of the region. And is there a way in which you can use as a template the kind of things that we're doing, or begin to do things beyond the Asia-Pacific and then do them later within the Asia-Pacific? And I also want to talk to you about something, get your view on that. And then secondly, on the mill-to-mill, you mentioned humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. But is there more that we can do beyond that? Can we be more ambitious and move beyond the humanitarian assistance and disaster relief and do other things? And I've heard you talk about this before, and I want to get your reaction to that.
I think one of the things that, as you said, we've talked about before is very good cooperation, very good coordination, and as the farther you are from the areas where there are disputes and competing claims, and historical animosities that come into play.
Strategic rivalries.
But I think that in walking back into the region with a set of activity to do some of those more benign types of exercises and begin in areas that are not as sensitive, particularly around some of the islands in question and islands or features that have been identified in the ruling by the Court of Arbitration. I think it is possible to begin working with some of the other countries in what I would call more military type of activity. Even things such as gunnery exercises, but to do them multilaterally, and I understand the sensitivities that go with that. But you could begin to put together some very basic, what I would call military skill exercises that would allow a higher level of professional activity, but it's not a major warfighting demonstration. And to include China in that, to include the other countries, because I think it's important that we in the U.S. have to keep in mind that the countries in the region have a unique relationship with China, economically, geographically, and we need to begin to craft activities that allow them to interact more normally in a military sense, and we can be part of that. We can be a catalyst, and we can be a participant.
I often say countries in the region, as far as I can tell, aren't looking to choose sides between the U.S. and China, and they want to try to figure out how to have a relationship with both. And I think that's part of what you're saying. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about North Korea. Just this week, they've conducted their fifth nuclear test. It was the largest test that they've conducted. They've done a lot of missile tests this year. And they did their first ever successful missile launch from a submarine. Which all of this combined gives them enhanced capabilities and moves them closer, of course, to being able to put a nuclear warhead on a missile and potentially range the United States. How do these enhanced capabilities, how do you see these, especially the submarine aspect of being able to launch missiles from submarine, How does this change the equation for us?
Well, I think it changes it in a couple ways. One, the continued nuclear testing is very problematic. It's an issue that I believe not just the United States and China need to deal with, but on a global basis. This is a significant, serious development, particularly given the nature of the leadership and particularly the judgment that's been displayed by the leader in North Korea. So that's on the higher level that's in play. But I think it also indicates that that the potential for North Korea to threaten the region and eventually the United States has moved into a new domain. Mm. And you know, we can talk about various defensive systems, but the advent of a submarine as a potential launching mechanism is significant. And this is not a new threat, because if you go back a few years and you remember the sinking of the Cheonan, that was done by a submarine. And so we now have to become very, very serious about this.
Yeah.
Make the investments, and this is a regional issue, make the investments in anti-submarine warfare, maritime domain awareness, intelligence sharing, so that there can be a common intelligence picture of what may be moving, what may be in port, what may have left port. And so I think it's important that regionally we begin to pull this together. Mm-hmm. I think it also means that as these capabilities are developed, and particularly the advent of a submarine as a launching platform, that there has to be a realistic view by countries in the region that we and our allies will put in place the defensive mechanisms that we need to assure the safety of our people, of our allies, and the region. And because the warning times now that are able to be discerned from the operation of a submarine are significantly reduced. So there has to be an acceptance and openness and a realization that modern, effective, frontline missile defense systems are going to have to be in play until the behavior and the actions of North Korea change.
Yeah. Democratically elected leaders of countries cannot stand by and not do anything in the face of enhanced danger, enhanced threat. And clearly we're seeing that play out with North Korea. Now, you and I are on the margins here, on the margins of high-level U.S.-China dialogue. And, of course, China has objected to THAAD. You know, my own view is that North Korea is actually taking advantage of some of the tension in the U.S.-China relationship over THAAD, and has done this nuclear test because they know that there's this widening gap between the U.S. and China. But what you said is these kind of things, at least what I heard you say, is these kind of defensive measures, missile defense and other things, will have to continue as the threat grows more imminent. How then do we deal with that in the context of U.S.-China relations?
I think in this case, and as I have read some of the reaction in the open press by the Chinese, that there has to be a realization on the part of China that we must do what we must do to defend our people, our homeland, and that of our allies and partners. I believe that if China, as you alluded to, were to change their view on THAAD, which is a non-threatening system to China, it is absolutely non-threatening. If that view were to change, that potentially could change the calculus in what North Korea is doing. But this is a serious problem. Taking that capability to launch from a covert platform reduces reaction time, and it will be an imperative that we have the systems in place to react quickly.
How high will North Korea be on the next administration's agenda in terms of issues?
My sense is it's going to be extraordinarily high, as it should be, because of the threat that it poses regionally and globally with their nuclear weapons program and eventually delivery systems that can unsettle the region and beyond.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, sir. And I'd love to have you come back and visit us in China at some point soon.
I'd love to do that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for talking this morning.
Thanks.
That's it for this edition of Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.